Warren Buffett, BlackRock, and other institutional players dominate investments in commercial aviation. Why? Because it's one of the most profitable and predictable alternative assets that exists. And it's not tied to other markets, such as real estate and the stock market. Is it safe? Well, imagine triple net leases to the likes of American Airlines and British Airways. Income is contractual and guaranteed by some of the biggest named airlines in the world. That's why this kind of investment was never available to the ordinary accredited investor. That is until now. Visit accesswealthaviation.com and check it out for yourself. Invest in an institutional team with over 200 plus years of combined investment experience in the aviation sector. Conservative investing with double-digit returns and tax advantages. That's accesswealthaviation.com. accesswealthaviation.com.
You are listening to the Wealth Formula Podcast with Buck Joffrey. Get ready to change your life.
Welcome, everybody. This is Buck Joffrey with the Wealth Formula Podcast. And today I'd like to start out by reminding you that there's wealthformula.com. That is the home base for Wealth Formula Podcast. And that's where you can get all sorts of resources, including free books from yours truly and the likes of George Newberry. His book, Burn Zones, my book, Seven Secrets of Eternal Wealth. Lots of free stuff, great resources. Check out that website. Again, it's wealthformula.com. And also, if you cannot get enough of Wealth Formula, you ought to strongly consider joining our private network. The private network is great because it starts out with the course. The course gets us all on the same page with the likes of lecturers like Ken McElroy and Tom Wheelwright and Dean Graziosi, Christian Allen, all sorts of these really smart people, Kevin Day. And then you have an additional network on top of that. That network includes a private portal where we have ongoing content, private Facebook network, which is popular, obviously, so you can communicate with one another. And finally, perhaps the most popular thing of them all, bi-weekly mastermind call. So if you're trying to find your community, if you are the type of person who loves talking money and investing, etc., but none of your neighbors like to talk about it, that was me basically, right? None of your friends really like talking about money. That was me basically. Then you ought to join this group, Wealth Formula Network, and it's all rolled up into one. Check it all at wealthformularoadmap.com. Again, that's wealthformularoadmap.com. Speaking of Ken McElroy and Tom Wheelwright, they will be amongst the group speaking at our first Wealth Formula meetup in Scottsdale, Arizona on March 2nd. The event actually starts informally on the 1st for a meetup, informal meetup at a local watering hole. And then the next day, we will have lectures from Ken McElroy, Tom Wheelwright, David Steele from Western Wealth Capital. Then we'll have lunch. Then we will hear from Christian Allen, Damian Lupo. Then we'll go on a magical bus tour that includes viewing what forcing equity looks like in real time. And you're going to enjoy it. You may even see properties if you're an investor club that you already have part ownership in. So it should be pretty darn cool. And frankly, I just think it's going to be the coolest thing to be able to meet you all in person. We already have, I think, 65 people registered for this. We're capped at about 100. It's not till March, so there's still a little bit of space left. If you want to come, now is the time to check it out. And I should also point out that there is the special for the hotel rooms and stuff basically ends after this week. At the end of January, all these specials that we got on hotels, et cetera, are done. So check it out. Go to wealthformulaevents.com. Sign up now. Like I said, we're capped at around 100. We're already at around 65 people. And, we still got well over a month. So I think we're going to cap probably within the next couple of weeks is my guess. But I would love to see you there. And I'm going to make a strong effort to try to meet every single one of you. But I'm really bad with names, so we're going to have name tags. Anyway, let's talk about today's show. It sounds kind of like, it's a little depressing, right? It's like poverty and inequality. Who cares about poverty and inequality? Well, you know, it's strange to think of the way our politics have evolved, even in my lifetime. Of course, I'm no spring chicken. I'm 45 years old. But the first president I remember, and barely remember, frankly, is Jimmy Carter. The first real memory I have is my dad was overseas on a business trip. And I remember being, I think I was in kindergarten or before kindergarten, I don't know. But he asked me what was going on, and I said, I was watching the elections here, Daddy, and I saw that Ronald Reagan won the election. I think I called it before it was officially called, but it was clear that everybody on TV was saying that Ronald Reagan was going to be president. So most of my grade school years were spent in Reagan years. Now, after a bumpy start to the Reagan administration, I mean, we did inherit a terrible economy at that time. But Paul Volcker came in and, you know, Reagan worked a little bit of magic and we had the roaring 80s. As you can tell, I liked Ronald Reagan very much. I like Ronald Reagan very much. And that's the kind of Republican that I am. I'm not a Trump Republican. I know some of you will disown me for that, but I'm not. Anyway, it was a decade remembered, you know, the 1980s, where it was a decade remembered for wealth and excess. You remember, if you're my age or around there, you remember what it was like. You had those movies like Wall Street with Michael Douglas. You had Michael J. Fox as Alex P. Keaton on Family Ties. Remember that? You know, the Republican Party at the time was pretty clearly the party of the rich, and it made little effort to concern itself with the poverty and equality issues of the day. And frankly, you know, it didn't really matter in some ways. Ideologically, it was a different mindset back then, right? The appealing nature of the 1980s in hindsight was that it was so aspirational. The early, you know, after the initial Reagan bump, the real bumpy ride at the very beginning, it was so aspirational. It was indeed morning in America. And for those of you who know what I'm talking about, this was a Reagan commercial during the election, which was talking about a new America after the hopelessness of the Carter economy. Everyone seemed so optimistic with Ronald Reagan. Now, that's why, in fact, that even the middle class, the traditionally Democratic bastion of unions and the Democratic Party, well, they defected and they became what was known as Reagan Democrats. And the party actually continued. The party, meaning like the happy days of America, continued through the 90s into the Clinton years. In fact, Clinton represented a new kind of Democrat who had to pivot from the old kind of Jimmy Carter Democrat. He embraced Wall Street and free trade. He was the one who was actually responsible, frankly, for the ability of banks to grow into hedge funds and use the same FDIC-insured money to make big bets with everybody else's money. And that was called the Glass-Steagall repeal, and that was under the Clinton administration. So, listen, at the end of the day, the difference between in policy between the Clinton Democrats and the Reagan Republicans or, you know, the Bush Republicans was pretty nominal at that point. And why? Because rising tides raise all ships. And even if some ships are rising more than others, that's okay. Even those ones that are rising a little less, they're still pretty happy. You know, a recent Brookings Institute analysis found that out of the last five presidents, the largest annual income gains in the middle class occurred during the Reagan and Clinton years. In general, if you remember those years, these were really good times in America for people in general. Now, I know there was plenty of families that were struggling. I mean, my wife's family was struggling back in those years, too, and her parents were very much anti, you know, Reagan. But generally, people as a whole were optimistic about the country and the way things were going. And that's why in 1984, you saw such a massive landslide of Reagan defeating Walter Mondale, who was the vice president for Jimmy Carter. And also, by the way, a Minnesotan. Back then, I remember Mondale only won the state of Minnesota and the District of Columbia. So anyway, now to be clear, I just want to point something out. There is a ton of data showing that it makes no statistical difference to the economic performance of the country at large here, whether there's a Republican or Democrat in the White House. In fact, the study, the ITR Economics guys did a study on that. And if anything, I hate to say it, but there is a slight advantage to the Democrats. What I'm getting at here is that when times were good economically for the middle class, there was less divisiveness in the country. That's all I'm trying to get at here. And it's no coincidence that over the last two decades, now, median household incomes have barely budged. Employment and wages are declining, and that happens to correspond to the rise of political divisiveness, demagoguery, and nationalism. You know, you've got almost 80% of Americans believing today that the children of today will grow up worse off than their parents. Think about that. Think about that, right? I mean, that isn't mourning in America. That's downright depressing. Now, what happens when people are not doing well and people are worried about the future and the future of their children? It starts with blaming everyone else around you for your problems, right? Specifically, if you can find a minority group or somebody else to point out as part of the problem, then that seems to be a human tendency. And maybe that's why, you know, anti-Semitism and white nationalism is on the rise. I mean, people become more tribal and insular during times of economic crises. They stick with their own and look for scapegoats. And the worst example of that, of course, in recent history was Nazi Germany, which followed a horrific economic period of hyperinflation following the World War I reparations that it had to pay. Now, we see a lot more divisiveness in our politics, and both parties right now are pandering to our worst instincts. And I really hate that, frankly, that my kids are growing up in this kind of polarized country right now. It's awful for them to even see what's going on television and what, you know, leaders of the country are saying. Now, listen, here's the thing. Most of us are doing pretty well. Those of us who listen to this show, listen to me, and we've made a lot of economic gains over the past several years. We've been riding the bull market after the Great Recession. So it's not really that easy necessarily to recognize all this underlying strife that exists in the underbelly of America. But that's a mistake. It's a mistake. Why? Because eventually, when everyone is hurting enough, they will come for us with pitchforks. Now, what do I mean by pitchforks? Well, that could be civil unrest. That could be just what it sounds like. Or it could be a 70% tax bracket for the top couple of percent of taxpayers that was recently suggested by the likes of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. It's time to take this seriously, bottom line is. You cannot ignore it. It won't go away. And there are a lot of people who you might not expect to care that much about inequality and poverty and that sort of thing. But those people who are smart, and they're speaking extensively about the issue. Robert Kiyosaki is one of them, right? Robert Kiyosaki, to his credit, has been very concerned about economic inequality and the shrinking middle class. Also, of course, billionaire Charles Koch, you know, of the Koch brothers, Charles Koch, Koch, you know what I'm talking about. Anyway, you know, these guys are known as, you know, from Democrats and from people who are generally, you know, left of center and further left than that, as very horrible people. But even Charles Koch, who's CEO of Koch Industries, billionaire, even him, he understands and has written extensively about the problem that exists there. And it's exactly because of that. He knows that, you know, this kind of inequality and poverty actually creates an unstable America. And in an unstable America, it's really hard for any of us to prosper. And Koch is, of course, a libertarian, and he represents many of the potential ideas to try to address some of these problems that the libertarian side has. So today we're going to talk to another libertarian from the Cato Institute named Mike Tanner, who shares a lot of the same things that Charles Koch writes about. A lot of this is common sense strategies that may be more nuanced than simply raising taxes. And in fact, these strategies are probably the ones that make the most sense, but unfortunately get the least political attention. So, and when we come back, Mike Tanner of the Cato Institute. Worried about saving too little too late for retirement? The Wealth Accelerator may be exactly what you need. With the help of some of the oldest and most reliable insurance companies in the country, Wealth Accelerator allows you to take most of the upside of any good year in the stock market and use bank loans to magnify those returns significantly. And what if the stock market has a bad year? No need to fear. Wealth Accelerator is engineered so you don't participate in the losses of the market, no matter how bad of a year it is. Sounds too good to be true, right? But it's not. It's simply the same financial engineering that the ultra wealthy have been doing for years. Now it's your turn. Check it out for yourself by going to wealthformulabanking.com. Again, that's wealthformulabanking.com. Self-storage is a necessary evil. It's where you keep your stuff and forget about it. No wonder this stuff is so profitable and recession-resistant. The Wealth Formula community, well, we've benefited from that. We've made lots of money in this space with Reliant Real Estate, one of the largest self-storage companies in the country. With an average investor internal rate of return of almost 34%, with hold times just over 3.5 years, these guys know what the meaning of velocity of money is. If you're an accredited investor, make sure to check out what they're up to right now at ReliantFund4.com. Again, that's ReliantFund4.com. Welcome back to the show, everyone. Today, my guest on Wealth Formula Podcast is Michael Tanner. Mike is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, where he heads research into a variety of domestic policies, with a particular emphasis on poverty and social welfare, healthcare reform, and Social Security. Mike is a true thought leader. I mean, he is the author of numerous books on public policy, and his writings have been in nearly every American, at least American newspapers, and New York Times and Washington Post. The Congressional Quarterly named him one of the nation's 5 most influential experts on Social Security, and the New York Times refers to him as a lucid writer and skilled polemicist. Michael, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Well, listen, I want to start out, I have to admit, you know, being from the Cato Institute, which is a libertarian think tank, I was somewhat surprised to see that as a libertarian, you focused on issues of poverty and social welfare policy. It's not typically what you think of when you hear of libertarian rhetoric per se. How did you get interested in this topic?
Well, I think it actually should be something that's central to libertarian policy and libertarian rhetoric, because the reason I'm a libertarian is that I believe in the equal worth and dignity of every person. And the reason I pursue libertarian policies is to enable basically what might be called human flourishing, the idea that society is better. And that's every person, from those people at the top to those people at the very bottom. And libertarians happen to have solutions that will enable people at the bottom to become full economic participants and basically rise up the economic ladder.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that. Fundamentally, from a policy perspective, I'm just sort of contrasting it a little bit from what you typically kind of hear, right? You hear a little bit of different rhetoric sometimes with people, at least who call themselves libertarians. Okay, so let's kind of focus in on why we should care about this. So I'm living an upper middle class life, working as a doctor or a lawyer. I'm doing fine. I'm living the quote unquote American dreams. You know, outside of the fact that I should care because I'm not an evil person who doesn't care about anybody else, in practical terms, why should I care about income inequality and poverty?
Well, in practical terms, aside from the simple fact that you should care about your fellow man, there's the fact of stability in society. I mean, we don't want to end up being some sort of South American country where you have gated communities and then the great masses outside trying to get in and take your stuff. basically, we want people in our society who can look, you know, who feel like they're part of that society and feel like they have a stake in the stability of it and in moving forward. Plus, you need those folks who are educated, hardworking, willing to invest and take risks if you expect the economy to grow. And of course, you're not going to get rich yourself unless they're part of it.
Yeah. In other words, if you want society to flourish, you got to have, you have to address this issue. And so we all stand to gain from it. And sometimes I think that message gets lost a little bit. Give me some actual examples of libertarian policies on dealing with poverty and how specifically they might be different from some of the traditional Democratic and Republican policy agenda.
Sure. Well, I think that first of all, you have to look at why people are poor. And I think that Republicans have generally indulged in some form of victim blaming. They have basically said people are poor because they make poor decisions. They don't work. They drop out of school. They get pregnant when they're not married and so on. The left says, well, that's fine as far as it goes, but you have to look at why people make those bad decisions. And that has a lot to do with racism and gender discrimination and economic dislocation. What I suggest is that both of those have something to them. But they also miss the larger point, which is that government policies are often responsible for the problems, regardless of which side of that debate you come down on. And that means we need to look at things like criminal justice reform, a school choice and educational freedom, forming housing laws, zoning and land use laws to bring down the cost of rent, banking laws and other ways they block the poor from participating in savings and investment. And finally, we need to make any economic growth we have inclusive. That means getting rid of occupational licensures, occupational zoning, the minimum wage, things that block the poor from getting in and starting up that economic ladder.
So let's kind of drill down on some of those, if we might. It's let's start with criminal justice reform. What's wrong with the system now and how can we improve it?
Well, we know that the criminal justice system as it is now is heavily biased against the poor and people of color. But even leaving that aside, the general overcriminalization of our society means that you have large numbers of people, particularly in low-income and minority communities, who are, in fact, rendered outside the economic mainstream because they have a criminal record. If you get busted for having drugs, let's say, when you're in your 20s, and later on in your 40s, and you go to apply for a job, you still have to put down that you have a felony record, and that can often prevent you from getting a job. It can prevent you from renting an apartment in many places or getting into college or getting support for your college education. So we need to look at what the criminal record ultimately means to people. And in particular, it also increases problems for women in the inner city because you're basically taking their marriage partners out of the pool. William Julius Wilson at Harvard has done a lot of work on this and talks about how you're taking 1.5 million young men out of the marriage pool in inner cities, and then we're surprised when you have large numbers of women giving birth outside of marriage. Scholars at Vanderbilt estimate that if we were to reform our criminal justice system, we could reduce poverty by about 20% in this country by that one fact alone.
And when you say reformer, you're talking about specifically maybe some specific examples of that might be, say, for example, you're talking about overcriminalization, maybe some of the drug-related convictions, maybe some of those could be less stringent, and maybe there could be some limitations in terms of how long a felony or something like that stays on your record?
Well, absolutely. I think it starts top to bottom, everything from the way we police our cities to the way we what we criminalize. It's not just drugs, although that's certainly part of it, but sex work and gambling. You know, let's remember that Eric Garner, who was killed in New York City, was committing the crime of selling an untaxed cigarette. So there's a host of things that shouldn't be crimes that are in our society. It has to do with the way we plea bargain. It has to do with how we sentence people once they're there, and then how we treat people once they're in prison. So it's basically a top-to-bottom change in the criminal justice system, one that's designed to punish those small number of recidivist people who commit serious crimes that harm other people and basically treats other people with a little bit of dignity.
So you also talk, I know, a little bit about some zoning laws and how those negatively impact the poor. Can you talk about why that is the case?
Sure, it hurts in several ways. First of all, we know that rent takes up a large portion of income for low-income people, that they disproportionately pay a bigger share of their income in rent. It's about 40% on average. And so anything that drives up the cost of housing or drives up rent is going to leave poor people at a disadvantage. And the evidence suggests that land use laws and rent zoning laws have a huge impact on rent. In some cases, they can, like Manhattan and San Francisco, they can drive up the cost of rent by 50%. In other cities, Washington, D.C. and Baltimore, it's 30 to 40% and so on across the board. That's a huge impact that makes it much tougher for poor people to live. In addition, those high rents force poor people into certain low-income neighborhoods and prevent them from moving to areas that might have better schools, lower crime, or more jobs. You know, if you have the skill and want to try to move into Silicon Valley, good luck, because the rents are simply unaffordable.
How does, in practicality, though, how would that work? If you're not, I guess my question is, I was just thinking about this as you were saying that. You know, I was in San Francisco around Thanksgiving, and there was an area that my wife used to be in that live that area, and she told me it was low income housing, which I was kind of surprised by because, you know, a block later we saw, you know, these multi-million dollar homes. If those areas weren't zoned that way, would those people living in those low income areas have to move? Would they have to move somewhere else entirely? I'm just trying to understand.
Well, you'd have more housing available for people with low income. You don't have to just build low income housing as well. If you build more high density, high income housing, people who are able to afford those but have been confined to lower cost areas because of the zoning laws and the added sort of zoning tax, they would then move up, and that opens up their housing to other people, and you get this sort of chain reaction moving up the housing scale. Basically, what you want to do is have more high-density housing in certain areas, particularly around transportation hubs. What you want to do is be able to build in areas that don't have all sorts of restrictions limiting on housing. You know, in San Francisco, just to cite one example, there's restrictions on having to have more than one parking space per apartment in the city. Things like that add enormously to the cost of a house or an apartment.
Yeah, absolutely. So another thing that you mentioned a little bit was occupational licensing. Talk a little bit about the overregulation, perhaps, in terms of occupational licensing and, you know, how that affects the situation.
Sure. 25 to 30% of all jobs today require you to get a license from the state in order to be able to practice it. And I'm not talking about doctors and lawyers. I'm talking about things like beauticians and hair braiders and funeral attendants and interior designers and so on, a variety of jobs that people with low skills or families or simply entering the labor force for the first time, the type of jobs that they would take, they're often blocked out of. And it's not just that you have to get the license, but that the procedures for getting those licenses are often onerous. To cite just one example, in Louisiana, if you want to be a beautician, you have to take a course, which is an expensive course and lasts a long time. Then you have to take a test. That test is a 2-day test, and it's only given in Monroe, Louisiana, which means that you have to be able to find transportation and a hotel room overnight, take the test, hope you pass it, pay to take the test, of course. Now, if you're a low-income single mother trying to get her first job, that's a real barrier for you.
What do you do instead? I mean, do you have some barriers? I mean, where do you draw the line, though? I guess that's really kind of the question that comes up. I mean, who determines, you know, whether or not you need to have a license or not for a given,
About the customer, yeah. Basically. I think if you went to beauty school, cosmetology school, and you got a certification and you want to put that in your window so your customers know, great.
Right.
But if I want to go to my next door neighbor because she's, pretty good at cutting hair and I want to let her do it, why not?
Yeah. I guess another example of how that can potentially open up economic opportunity on an enterprise level, you look at something like Uber, which, you know, essentially democratized this, you know, what used to be a monopoly of taxi companies. Is that the kind of thing that you kind of are looking as as ways to increase economic growth and opportunity?
Oh, absolutely. Uber has been a godsend for the poor. First of all, in terms of jobs, because it enables them to work around odd schedules. All you need is a car to be able, basically in a computer to be able to hook up to it. So it has provided a source of jobs for low people with few skills and entering the labor force. But it's also enabled poor neighborhoods to get service that they often couldn't get. Taxis are often reluctant to take people to low-income, high-crime neighborhoods. Uber's been much more willing to do that sort of thing.
Yeah, especially if a lot of the people are actually living in those neighborhoods. It allows them that level of empowerment as well. Let's talk a little bit about unemployment, unemployment insurance. You know, this is a tricky one, right? So what is the practical, first of all, how do you feel about unemployment insurance? What's the data and what's your take on it?
Well, the evidence suggests that unemployment insurance in the short term benefits the unemployed, but in the long term it tends to hurt them. It actually keeps them out of the labor market longer. We know the evidence suggests that when somebody gets laid off, for example, in the first couple of months after they're laid off, they spend a great deal of time looking for another job. And then they go into a trough where they don't spend a great deal of time looking. And then as their unemployment benefits are about to run out, they suddenly begin to look again. The problem is if that's a year or two down the line, their skills may have atrophied to the point where they can no longer get the type of job that they want. So it does have an impact, we know, in terms of household income, and it has an impact in terms of returning to the labor force. So there are reasons to be concerned about it.
Yeah, as an employer, I've seen that happen as well, where literally people have asked to be fired. Rather than resign in these type of situations because they know they have that option for unemployment. But the thing that I wonder though, is kind of what is the alternative? Because obviously I'm talking about some situations where people are looking to specifically take advantage of the system. But what are the alternatives if you have people out there who don't have work and no money? What else can you do?
Well, ultimately, in any society, you're going to have a limit to unemployment insurance. Denmark, for example, just cut back to a two-year maximum in terms of their unemployment insurance. So even in sort of socialist Scandinavia, you're seeing limits on how long unemployment insurance can last. I mean, you can't say that forever. You lose a job when you're 22, and when you're 50, if you haven't gotten a new job, we're still going to be carrying you. So it's all a question of where you're going to draw the line and what limits you're going to have. And I would suggest that probably shorter is better.
Is there any other programs or training or anything like that that you advocate for?
Well, I think in terms of government programs, we haven't seen a huge amount of success. The government has a couple of dozen different job training programs, and very few of them provide any evidence that they make people more employable. In fact, there's some suggestion that some of these programs actually hurt your job chances. What it is it keeps you out of the labor force while you're doing the training, but you don't actually learn any new skills. So basically, it just makes you less employable over the long term.
Yeah, and that's, again, the problem that you have is you've got the government trying to, which is not terribly efficient and good at doing these kinds of things in the first place. So let me ask you this. These policy solutions that you offer. Obviously, I would say that a lot of people would listen to this and say, "Those are good ideas." Why aren't we hearing more about that? And in this political climate, with the increasing polarization between Democrats and Republicans, and there's not a lot of necessarily any significant political power from the actual libertarian, side, the Libertarian Party. What do you think the likelihood is of an actual bipartisan effort to deal with any of these issues of poverty in the near future?
Well, right now there's very little possibility of bipartisan agreement on motherhood and apple pie and the flag.
Yeah, right.
I mean, people are so dug into their various corners on this that it's going to be very difficult to get any agreement. However, I do think the type of agenda that I've been laying out holds promise. There have been, for example, bipartisan efforts at criminal justice reform. You see the SAFE Act in Congress right now. It's probably going to die this year, but it's been supported by liberals, by conservatives, Democrats, Republicans. Even the Trump administration has gotten behind it.
What is the SAFE Act? What exactly is that?
That basically would change some of the federal rules as far as sentencing, limit the use of three strikes and mandatory laws and mandatory minimum laws. It would make it easier for people in prison to earn credits by education and job training while they're in prison to get out a little bit. If they participate in these programs, they could get out a little bit earlier. It would go back and change some of the harshness in the sentencing laws for crack cocaine on a retroactive basis, where crack was punishable by at six times the rate of powdered cocaine. So it would make a number of small reforms. Most of the efforts at these reforms are going to have to take place at the state level, not the federal level, but certainly getting some federal momentum behind it's a good thing.
Mike, this has been really good stuff. Where can we learn more about your work?
Well, you can certainly go to cato.org and see check our website on this. And, of course, I have a new book that's out this weekend, and it's called The Inclusive Economy, How to Bring Wealth to America's Poor. And it's available on all the major sale book websites and in a bookstore near you.
So is that basically covering a lot of the issues we talked about today, the inclusive economy?
What we talked about today is basically a summary of it.
Exactly. So that's great. We'll definitely put a link to that in the show notes. And Mike, thanks again for being on Wealth Formula Podcast.
Anytime. Thank you.
Take care. Welcome back to the show, everyone. Now, I know poverty and income equality is not exactly a sexy topic, but it is important. And one other book I would suggest on the topic, if you're interested, is by Muhammad El-Aryan. The book is called The Only Game in Town. Now, on another note, I'm eager again to see everyone at our event in Scottsdale, Titans of Multifamily Real Estate. Make sure to check out the event at wealthformulaevents.com. By the way, we have some hotel specials again. I would just want to mention they are expiring at the end of January. So if you're planning to come, you should sign up and get your hotel rooms booked ASAP. Anyway, that is it for me this week on Wealth Formula Podcast. This is Buck Joffrey signing off.
Thank you for listening to the Wealth Formula Podcast. Visit us on the web at wealthformula.com. The information contained in this podcast are opinions, not fact. As always, consult your own financial team before making any investment. See you next time.
Buck Joffrey here from Sapio with Buck Joffrey. Aging might become reversible over the next 10 to 20 years. It's already being done in lab animals, so it's just a matter of time. Our challenge? To be healthy enough for when that time comes. As a former scientist and surgeon myself, my goal is to figure out how to do that and to share it with you. I wrote a book called Living Longer for Busy People that you can download for free at sapiopodcast.com. You'll be amazed at just how a few daily adjustments can add years of a healthy life for you. Again, download it for free, sapiopodcast.com.